Well, thanks to everybody for coming. We're a small but committed group, I think, and we have a really interesting topic today, talking about the election, and we've had a switch. We decided that maybe we should call it Engineering Victory, which is the provocative first part of the title, and then we'll go with the end of personalist politics and consolidation of dominant party rule. And our speaker today is Regina Smith, who I think many people in the room know, but for those of you who don't, she got her PhD at Duke and is currently teaching at Indiana. Before that was at Penn State. And she has a new book that's just out. I thought there was a better title for this too, wasn't it? Run, Yvonne, Run?
It used to be called.
And now it's called Candidate Strategies and Electoral Competition in the Russian Federation. Jeez, you know. Or what makes Yvonne run? Wasn't that going to be it? Something like that. Yeah. So, but it's just out in the Cambridge series. So, but this is new work that she's going to be presenting today. So, please just share.
There's not much new data in this work, but it's sort of a new argument, and it was an argument that some of you may find sort of contentious. So we could fight it out. What I want to argue is that Russia is undergoing yet another transition. This transition is from personalist politics, where personalities and clientelist sort of networks are at the center of politics, moving to actually the consolidation of a dominant or hegemonic party. I should say that this paper is co-authored with two graduate students at IU, Brandon Wilkiny and Anna Urasova. I will, to protect them, say that they disagree with my optimism about the consolidation of a hegemonic party. And although I understand that's not an optimistic outcome, I do think that will be the outcome of this wrangling. So let me just start by saying what we mean by the consolidation of a personalist regime. I want to argue that from 2000 to 2005, essentially, what Putin was doing was building on relative economic prosperity, and his own personal popularity to create a system in which elite advancement was almost entirely dependent on him. And this included a strategy of formal institutional change and also the growth of use of informal mechanisms. So we have here a personalist politics where the leader is the guarantor of elite bargains and keeps order within the elite arena, and he's also the figure that mobilizes electoral support. And you may remember that after the 2003 election, in a number of public opinion polls, when people were asked why they voted for United Russia, they said because it's Putin's party, despite the fact that Putin never joined the party. And the primary mechanisms of political control during this period where the state was really quite weak were informal institutions, personalist networks, clientelism, state patronage, control of the coalition formation agenda, that is, Putin got to define who was friends with whom, and selective coercion, which turned out to be significant and important. What I want to talk about is how that personalist regime, together with semi-authoritarianism, this concept we sort of throw around a lot but never think about very seriously, creates some interesting problems for sustained governance or control. So I want to take just a couple of minutes to think seriously about what semi-authoritarianism means and what implications it has for the leader. We've seen these definitions, and I'm not wedded to the language. If you want to call it a hybrid regime or a competitive electoral regime, that's fine with me. Where the comparative advantage always goes to the incumbent order, that is, that there is a manipulation of the electoral process in order to sustain the incumbent order. The use of informal mechanisms to influence formal electoral processes, for instance, you buy up and control all the media for opposition candidates. Harassment of opposition figures, you could say, put them in jail, like we did, like Putin did to Khodorkovsky. And that leads to a limited alternation of power within the context of the structure. So then you have a regime that has elections. The elections are relatively competitive, although controlled, and where informal mechanisms actually determine outcomes rather than formal rules. What we really have when we talk about competitive authoritarianism is two arenas of political contestation. So if we try to think about this a little more rigorously, we have the factional arena where you have elites battling it out for control of the state and state resources, And on the other side, you have the mobilizational arena where you have masses, the room for participation of the masses and mass judgment and mass action. So these two arenas interact in three key ways. The first is in the inter-election period, where, say, an unpopular policy, like, say, the monetization of public goods, is very unpopular. So opposition elites go down into the electorate to try to mobilize them and challenge the existing order. And we saw that after that monetization debacle, where the Communist Party, together with the church and other social organizations, orchestrated mass protests across Russia and essentially affected change. During that period, interestingly enough, there were a number of governors who then defected from Putin and actually either didn't implement the policies or totally disavowed the policies and, for instance, restored pension payments. And Lushkov, for example, restored tickets for free rides on the subway against the bills. So we saw a moment of relatively potentially large elite defection, and then the state backed off. The second period in which they interact is the election period through political parties or candidates with personal vote mechanisms. So it could be both ways, where elites go down in and try to mobilize the electorate to challenge the existing order. A good example of how this worked was after the financial crisis of 1998, when Lushkov and Primakov see an opening, an unpopularity of the ruling order, unite together to try to organize a party to challenge the existing order. And then you have post-election period protests, these colored revolutions. And we could, one implication of this talk is why we won't see a colored revolution in Russia. So we have another paper called Russia's Colorless Politics, in case anybody's interested. So I won't work all the way through this, but what this does, these two arenas and these two sets of strategies, create a number of ways in which, or a number of threats to the regime that have to be quelled in order for the incumbent order to stay in power. So for instance, in the factional arena among elites, you have challenge, they can challenge for control of the state patronage networks, as governors did under the Yeltsin period, to try to take control of that. You can have activation of new resources, such as oil wealth or banking wealth or international support in order to challenge the incumbent order. And you can have new alliances with previous elites. On the other extreme, on the mobilizational mass arena, masses can vote for opposition. And here the constant threat is populism or a populist appeal to the incumbent order. There can be a vote against all mechanism where you basically vote against all of the candidates, therefore negating the legitimacy of the election, or a lack of turnout, which up until a few months ago would have nullified the election. Now the turnout requirement in elections has been removed, so voters can't express themselves either in a lack of turnout or in votes against all. Both of those mechanisms have been removed from by changing formal rules. Oh, sorry. Left or right? Okay, so here, not to drag this setup out too long, but personalism plus semi-authoritarianism creates two big problems for the regime. The first is succession crises, and Henry Hale's written fairly eloquently about this in his paper on world politics on patronal presidents, where you see once the threat of the president leaving means that he can't credibly commit to elite bargains and elites defect. And the second problem is, and here I'm drawing on the new work by Helmke and Levitsky about the role of informal institutions in a lot of these regimes, you have a case where informal and formal institutions are out of sync. That is, the goals of formal institutions are pluralism, competition, and competitiveness, and the goals of informal institutions are control, restriction, and maintaining order, stability. So you have a case in which these two things are contrary and where formal institutions are relatively weaker than informal institutions. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. So the solution, I argue, there are many solutions, but I'm going to argue for this one. The solution is to try to eliminate these threats by creating a single hegemonic party. Succession crises are then not a problem because it's the party who's the guarantor of the bargains, not the individual president. Real power and policy decisions are contested outside of the mobilizational arena, within the party elite, in the factional arena. And the dominant party, if successfully consolidated, basically tames all the lists, all the threats on that big slide. Right or left? There we go. sorry. So why do I think this is possible when the comparative literature on hegemonic parties tells us it's virtually impossible and the cases of hegemonic parties are relatively rare? Well, let me just start by looking at some of the, if you'd look at the literature on hegemonic parties, whether it be from South Africa or from India, Mexico, or Venezuela earlier, maybe happening again now, or Italy in the post-war period, you get a list of sort of things that happen to create hegemonic parties. The party has to originate from and in the state structure. Okay, well, we have that one covered. A constituency, you need a constituency that demands state patronage. Russians are a constituency that are very happy to demand state patronage. There's a lot that needs to be done, a lot of services that need to be provided, and I'm going to talk about some public opinion data that says they're very satisfied with this provision of particularistic state patronage. Sid Terrell argues in the Italian case that you need an intra-class coalition. That is, you need a hegemonic party that either spans classes or the party that can create a coalition with another party that so the coalition together spans classes. I'm going to show you that that's happening, that that's the logic of this friendly opposition that Putin's creating called just Russia, just meaning fair. You need state patronage, state resources to bribe the patronage. We have that in oil revenue. Now, here's the one where people like Steve Hansen say, see, I told you it's impossible. You have an ideology that excludes all other leaders from mobilizing voters. And we'll talk about that in the end. So that is that you need sort of an orchestrating revolutionary ideology to form a dominant party. Okay, so how does Putin do it? What's the idea here? Well, the idea is you change the formal institutions to support the emergence of the dominant party, so that the reforms that started out as quelling threats and building personalism now create an environment in which dominance is possible, a single party dominance is possible. So you create institutional incentives that foster coordination around a single party at the mass and elite level. So you provide incentives for elites to coordinate around this party in order to gain benefits, that masses will support the party, sort of willingly, you eliminate other forms of participation that might threaten the party, and you eliminate other venues where elites might try to participate or challenge the ruling order. How does he do it? Well, here we go through the list of Putin's reforms. The first step was to reorganize the federal districts, because the first set of elites that needed to be controlled and the first threat to the regime were the governors, were the regional players, including the regional economic actors. So you had a reorganization of the federal districts that created this strong mechanism of monitoring and sanctioning officials in the regions. Because the number of presidential representatives in the regions were smaller, they were personally connected with Putin. So we see an extension of a personalist network into the regions. These people gained control over key appointments. They were able to monitor and sanction regional officials, and as time went on, created a parallel mechanism for delivery of state patronage, where in some regions they were giving out a lot of money. They were the person to go to get money, not the governor. So the idea was to bypass the governor. This was combined with clear reforms of the federal structure. So the president first acquired the right to remove the governors, extending his personalist network. He eliminated elections to the upper house of parliament. That took care of two problems. One was a veto threat over legislation, and the other was removing the governors from the national arena. He rescinded bilateral agreements and reestablished relatively symmetric, and I don't want to push this too far, federal relations. That is, he took away resources from the richest regions and damaged what had previously undermined what the control of natural resources in the rich regions. And then eliminated elections of governors and, most recently, a discussion of eliminating elections of mayors. So here you have, you're making all of these people reliant on the president in order to get their jobs through a clientelist network. At the same time, there were significant fiscal reforms. Here you might have something to say, Scott. to regain control over tax revenues and redistribute those revenues. So there was a centralization of tax collection, transparency to the system, tax reform, and significantly at the same time that this was all happening so that the governors couldn't keep those revenues in the regions, there was a significant decrease in budgetary transfers, direct budgetary transfers from the center to the regions. So therefore, thereby undermining governors' ability to build their own independent patronage networks. So federal and fiscal reforms together gives a logic of support for a hegemonic party at the voter level. And here I want to draw on a study of the PRI in Mexico by Barry Weingast, Beatrice Megaloni, and Alberto Diaz, two of my colleagues from Duke, who model a relationship through backward induction that shows why it is that voters might continually support the dominant party even if they don't agree with their policy, their overarching policy. This is that the voters' concern is with the delivery of goods and services. So they're aware of the fact that they need the state patronage in their daily lives. The reforms enhance the party capacity to monitor and punish regions that defect. That is, they know who's defecting, and what they do is, if you don't vote for the party, then they simply cut off the money. Voters anticipate the punishment and support the hegemonic party without direct coercion. Now, there's some evidence of this, actually. Popov, the economist, shows that distribution of money to the regions has direct relationship to voting, the predisposition in the vote. But it's a place where I think there could be some interesting work done about the relationship of the vote and alternative models of linkage. Okay. So together, fiscal and federal reforms bind regional elites to the regime and provide a logic for voters to support the party. At the same time, you have revisions in the national, in the electoral laws, both at the national and regional levels, both of which play an important role. So one of the most interesting changes, and sort of a puzzling one still, is the selection of proportional representation as the mechanism of election, because proportional representation usually leads to many parties, not two. And I'm going to make an argument about that in just a couple minutes. What Putin gets from PR is party control over entry ballot access, and that was really important. So now candidates, any ambitious candidate has to go through the party to contest in elections, and that was an important change, I think. Ballot access in Russia now requires support from every region in the country. So there are now two stages that parties have to go through to get on the ballot. The first is this registration process, and the second is a ballot access process. So ballot access requires what registration requires, that is, support from all regions. Only national parties can on the ballot, only big, rich parties. It also requires an incredible amount of paperwork, which parties are finding very onerous. And the paperwork has, financially onerous. And the paperwork has the added bonus of it's hard to meet the requirements, so it's easy to dismiss someone on the basis of all the paperwork. all candidates now must be party members. All parties must formulate their list with candidates from each region. That is, you need to have representatives from each region in order to get on the ballot to formulate your list. There's a 7% party threshold. This creates an enormous, potentially enormous seat bonus for large parties. And finally, you now cannot run as an electoral coalition. So the parties cannot, independent parties can't get together to run as a coalition. Now that's really important because it's these types of coalitions that have taken down people like Pinochet, where parties who have nothing in common except loathing the dictator or loathing the ruler come together to take down the ruler and then immediately break apart. So that's not possible. Yeah. No, that's okay.
So by region here, you mean the 7 federal districts? Or
no.
No. So what?
I mean the however many we have. We have a disagreement of voters on how many regions we have, right? 87.
89 or whatever.
Yeah. So yes, 80, that's really a significant.
So you have candidates from
yes.
89 regions.
Right. In order to get on the ballot. At the same time, you have a change in the regional election law, where it used to be mostly single-member district at the regional level, which really weakened party formation. Now you have this parallel system, 50% list PR, 50% SMD. It increases the influence of parties, and that's good for United Russia, because United Russia is the only party with a real presence across all these regions. It maintains the influence of state patronage down at the regional level. And as it did on the national level up until 2000, it fragments the opposition by siphoning off resources to independent candidates, viable independent candidates. And that's what the book is about. I'll plug the book too. On the regional level, you get a 7% electoral threshold again. That's a seat bonus for large parties. That's really helped United Russia on that regional level. And at this level, also, you have very stringent requirements by regional-level central election commissions that have barred parties that look like they're going to be problematic. And there are lots of examples of this, where parties are simply dismissed because they haven't fulfilled the paperwork or some small requirement. Now, the last set of formal reforms that I think are important to this story are the reforms in the party and party system. These are designed explicitly to limit opposition. So there's a new law, the new law on political parties that was actually passed in 2001 but doesn't come into force until 2006, so in this election, has requirements for registration that require 50,000 registered members of the party. In contrast, in Estonia, it requires 3 members to register a party, but 2 of them have to be Estonian. That's the requirement. This 50,000 number is matched only by Kazakhstan. So this is a huge number. This is a huge barrier. You have to have organizations in each of the regions, identifiable registered organizations. You have to be able to prove that to the Central Election Commission. The new laws also regarding party funding and parties also limit any international NGO funding for parties, as well as any funding from businesses that have significant international investment or partnership. So we also have this, but this is a clear effort to remove.
Gazprom?
Yeah. No Gazprom in the elections, unless Putin becomes the head of Gazprom. At the same time, within the party system, you have this creation of friendly opposition. So Putin's gone out and found, his friend, Sergei Mironov, and he said, okay, form a party. The party's called Just Russia. The party's program is this: reduce the growing income disparities by increasing wages and pensions, and attack the richest of the citizens. Okay, the only way they could carry that out is with the help of the dominant party. This is the party meant to appeal to lower classes, together with the coalition of UR, which is meant to appeal widely to the center, the very, very tiny middle class, and pretty much the rest. Okay. What's the effect of all these changes? What do we see on the ground now? First, I want to point out that we have seen only one effort of any elite in the Russian system to organize the new party in anticipation of elections next year. And that party wasn't registered. It was just barred through the registration procedure. And that was Kasyanov's organization. We see no, in the registration procedure, no nationalist or populist parties were registered, so they can't compete in 2007, 2008. We eliminate the threat of populism by eliminating populist leaders from the election cycle. Very weak opposition organizations were registered. So you have the perennial Green Party, Democratic Party of Russia, the Automobile Club, the Christians. They were all registered. They'll all run. Most observers think that they didn't even come close to meeting these registration requirements, and yet they were there. That will be part of what creates an enormous seat bonus, a large seat bonus. The friendly opposition is growing in support, so Just Russia emerges, and already it's shown up in the polls with some pretty significant support. And there's this potential to create the class alliance within the party system, this sort of working together of Just Russia and United Russia. The regional elections in March and then again in October were meant to be a testing out of the system. How well could UR do, and what changes might they need to make in anticipation of the next election cycle? Well, 66 of 87 regional executives are now members of the party. So they're avowed members of the party. Most major bureaucrats are members of the party, and there's a list of membership and registration. United Russia controls 69 of 87 regional legislatures. That is, they have a majority given their party delegation and their co-opting of independent candidates. UR has an absolute majority in the national legislature. UR is the only party that shows consistent signs of stable party ID. So this comes out of the Colton and Hale data, the surveys of 2000, 2003. It's the only party, even now the communists have fallen away, that has people self-identifying as a member of that party. We could argue about whether or not that's a fair response or not. UR has consistent report in any polls I've seen between 44 and 48%, regardless of how the competition's framed. So if we guess what the competition may look like, it doesn't matter, they get the same support. In the last regional elections, that is the last round, UR won majorities in 18 of 18 legislatures. That's sort of an unexpected feat. The interesting changes are in, and this is public opinion data from the regions. Voters say, why do voters say they vote for the party? Well, now only 7% of them say that they voted for the party because of Putin per se. More of them are starting to say it represents people like me, or they're the only party that do anything. What's even more interesting, and I think effective, is that the party itself is emerging as the patronage delivery vehicle, the particularist patronage. So the party in some of these problematic regions set up hotlines in cities. And you could call the hotline and report a problem, and they'd send people out to fix it, whether it be an electrical problem or a problem with the roads. So they're actually doing that kind of stuff. In the Far East, they went around fixing front doors. The party went around fixing everybody's front door, that is creating security, fixing the locks, with a little card that says United Russia, you know, was here. And they repaired or constructed playgrounds. So the party is taking a note right out of a number of these dominant party organizations and creating these services. And this is becoming more and more widespread. Okay. The next thing I tried to do to bolster the argument was to think about what these new rules mean for election outcomes. So the first thing I did was take these point estimates. These are the actual 2003 election results in the proportional representation race, and extrapolate from that what might happen in the next round. So in 2003, United Russia got 37.6% of the vote, and that gave them, with the single-member district seats together, 222 seats in the parliament. Now, under the new PR system, without those single-member districts, that same percentage of the vote plus the seat bonus from the parties that didn't make it over gives them 238 seats. And the difference here in the estimates A and B are under two different seat allocation rules, because there's some debate over whether or not they'll go from a more equitable seat allocation rule to a seat allocation rule that gives a slight advantage to large parties. So that's the difference. So if you just extrapolate that way, Putin's better off. Okay? Now, I also ran some Monte Carlo statistical experiments, and we can talk about it if you want to. What we did was take the precinct-level data and set up two scenarios. One was a scenario that mimicked 2003. That is, if all the parties that ran in 2003 ran again, what are the parameters? What's the distribution of outcomes if we vary the uncertainty in the race? And so we varied the uncertainty in the race extraordinarily widely. What was remarkable was how uncertainty didn't influence the outcome. That's the sort of consistent finding, is it doesn't matter if you say, let's let this vary, you know, extraordinarily widely or not widely at all, it's always a very tight prediction. And that prediction was 38%. Now, if we take a second scenario based on what we know happened in the registration procedures, and this is, I think, a conservative estimate of who will run, and this, again, is without any sort of seat bonus here, then we get the same result. That is, there's very little variation given uncertainty in the system, and United Russia under this scenario gets 42% of the vote. Okay, and again, I think that's pretty conservative. Okay, what do we do about this lack of ideology? Well, there appears to be in Russia a national consensus around stability as a goal rather than representation or other sort of democratic goals that we tend to hold dear. In the famous quote of Putin out of Valdai, he had one sentence where he used the word stability six times in the sentence. So this is Putin's message, stability, security, stability, security. Is that enough of an ideology? Maybe. It's also clear that the Kremlin understands and is responsive, albeit funnily, to popular concerns. So what we've seen in Putin since 2000 is an increasingly rabid nationalism. And some people say his rhetoric is as vitriolic as sort of the most nationalist figures in the system right now. You also see in the polls a consistent concern with corruption. And you have out of the Kremlin in Putin's speech in 2006 an announcement of an anti-corruption campaign. You have a lot of arrests around corruption. And you also have the government now printing pamphlets that says how to fight corruption in your everyday life. So you have a response to this concern about corruption, even though corruption is obviously a tool of this consolidation. So he's responsible to that. The other good example here is property rights protection. In 2000, United Russia ran on a platform of protecting property rights. That wasn't a very popular platform with the people, and Putin has abandoned that protection of property rights. That protection of property rights was a signal to elites that they could support him. And we see that. We can talk about that too if you'd like. So here we have a startling conclusion about Russian politics, that formal institutions now matter. That we've strengthened the formal state institutions and brought the informal and the formal structures into agreement. They're now both aimed at limiting competition. They're both aimed at undermining pluralist politics. Well, will it be successful? Let me give you quickly the pros and cons. There are significant incentives for one-party rule among the elite. First of all, it removes the succession threat repeatedly over time. And Geddes has a very nice paper where she studies differences in authoritarian regimes and finds that one-party regimes are by far the most durable type of authoritarian regime. Stability is not dependent on the health or popularity of one person, so it makes the system a little more predictable. Elites get to share in the decision-making, albeit out of the public arena, and have the shared goal of strengthening the party. And opposition elites can get a piece of the pie in terms of distribution of resources. The disincentives are also significant, and I don't want to downplay them. Elections always create uncertainty and opportunity. Anytime there's choice on the ballot, voters have the opportunity to use their power. In this case, I think, along with all these other formal rules, there's also a bunch of informal rules that could fix the ballot. And that may be a reason for selecting PR. It's easier to fix natural PR races. The other problem with this personalist party is corruption and rent-seeking as a side benefit of clientelism creates a lot of cost for the regime. And if corruption gets too high, it'll undermine the ability or the funding for state patronage, and it'll also undermine the distribution of state patronage. And that's a huge problem. There's limits on integration into the world economy. We see this happening now. Putin has repeatedly sort of closed off ties to the West, nationalizing industry. Government interference in industry is becoming greater so that you have an investment problem. You have out-of-system activity. Coup or political murder become viable tools of political contestation. And they may even become the only tools of political contestation. And you have the constant threat of exogenous shock. And Russia faces a lot of exogenous shocks. There are a lot of volatile situations that could go off that could cause problems. I think the talk has some other interesting implications for what would happen post-Putin. So there's a lot of speculation about what Putin will do as he leaves the presidency. This argument argues that he will actually leave the presidency, all things being equal. Although he'll always have time if they lose the parliamentary elections to decide not to leave the presidency. I think he's unlikely to eliminate the presidency or even take a position as prime minister because that undercuts the logic of state patronage as a coordinating mechanism. It just doesn't work. I think he's also unlikely to eliminate term limits because term limits are what control presidents from defecting from the bargains with elites in the future. They need term limits. So these seem to me incompatible with the logic of the formal reform institutions, that that's unlikely. Does that, should I say more about that?
I'm just wondering how that, go back to what you just said.
Okay. That's okay. That was a little jargony. I'm sorry. So it means that if the president has the incentive to play by the party rules, probably not the formal rules, right? Because if he doesn't do that, he'll be out of office in two terms, and they can punish him. Mm-hmm. So it's a way of keeping the president honest and making him honor his commitments to the other elites in the personalist faction. This is the argument for why term limits have never been questioned in Mexico under the PRI system. Okay, let me just end with this. This creates a big policy dilemma. And it creates a policy dilemma both, for the U.S., which I won't address, but for something I actually know a little bit about, it creates a policy dilemma for democracy assistance, which is a year before the election, Putin's won. But elections aren't free and fair. We see control of the media, use of selective coercion, elimination of opposition parties, increasingly restrictive regime structures. The problem is that election day processes will be fair, that Putin won't need to use fraud or coercion to win because he's done it through this manipulation of the system. There's a lot of popular support for Putin. I don't know if you saw recently his opinion ratings went up to 87%, which is just remarkable. Russians don't see electoral processes as unfair, and they don't see United Russia as being any more unfair than anybody else. Have you done some of those questions as well, Ted?
No.
And Russians think that their country is on the right track, that they're doing just okay with democracy. So not only are all of these coercive mechanisms in place, but there's a societal consensus now around this ruling order. So the dilemma is twofold. Given the growing consensus, how do we use our electoral monitoring infrastructure to do anything for Russia, to create incentives? Since if we go on that day and deploy our people around the country, we're not going to see much, right? So what do we do about that? We don't have a good response to that in the NGO community and the monitoring assistance. And the second question that it raises is, what should the role of democracy assistance be in Russia? And what should we be doing? This would suggest that what we should be doing is creating or working to help civil society to create infrastructure to the extent that we're able to do that, so that when the consensus breaks down, there's some possibility for initiative within the system. But it also suggests that any sort of focus or concentration on electoral monitoring, electoral assistance, really isn't going to do anything in this situation. So we have this situation where if the OECD goes in and observes on election day, it says, oh, elections weren't free and fair, but we didn't see any fraud. Okay, so that's it.
Thanks very much. Let's have some questions now.
So the idea that Putin is not rebuilding the Soviet Union, but is building up strong and free sounds right to me. But I guess it also seems to me that there are maybe a couple of ways that you could go about doing that. So one is to create a party like the Greens, so to really turn United Russia into a dominant party in a way that you suggest. The other is to rely upon another organization that has very strong identity, people who know us quite well, and that's the FSB. And you certainly see this with you certainly see a lot of people with security service backgrounds, staff in various positions and so forth. I'm just wondering, are these sort of, are these unrelated phenomena?
No, I don't think at all. I mean, I take this idea of selective coercion very seriously. And in the paper, with this argument in it, we've developed exactly that argument. I think they're complementary. The problem is, how does the FSB run for office? He has to win. That's the problem with semi-authoritarianism. You have to win an election. So how did they run candidates and win an election? They wouldn't. So he needs an electoral vehicle. I think they're an important tool to keep elites in line. And it's clear that, we have not seen any economic elite jump into the political arena since Khodorkovsky. And we're not going to.
Do you know from your candidate surveys what proportion of United Russia candidates have some sort of security service, security background of any sort?
It's something on the order of 22%. It's very high, there's no doubt about it. There's also, the problem is those people are now taking up these key bureaucratic positions, so they have two hats. They're wearing two hats. It's also the case that many of the United Russia members are now the same economic elites in the regions that used to fund campaigns and elections through the governor, and now they've joined the party. So we saw that happening a little bit in 2000, massively in 2003, and now they seem to be also now.
Shift from personal politics to the hegemonic party. As when you describe personal politics, you put it in terms of that any elite advancement is dependent on Putin, that there's a lot of clientelism and patronage, state patronage, and so on. But then when you actually talked about the institutional reforms to establish a hegemonic party, a lot of that depended on Putin and clientelism and state patronage and so on. So it seems to me you still have, even within this new party structure, a great deal of personal politics, it still is very dependent on Putin. And so it seems like the proof of the argument won't come until they actually have a transition. Does the hegemonic party survive in its form after Putin's gone? And then we'll know you're right. But
right.
Otherwise, if
this,
it kind of,
right.
Otherwise it could still be personal politics going on, and he's just using different mechanisms to do it, basically.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. This is the pivotal election. So if he exits the stage and they can still win,
right,
then that will be the telling point. I think. And this is basically
you know, where you jump off the cliff.
Right.
And, you know, mindful of being a student of Derry Huff and sort of say, you know, okay, it looks like this is what they're trying to do. This is why it might succeed. This is why it might fail. I want to reiterate this point. If it doesn't go well next December, then he has all sorts of options open to him.
Right.
But even if they win, isn't the issue, like, once he's gone, I mean, right now, within the governing elite, there are different factions, different, you know, clientelistic networks who are battling. And, I mean, one model of Russian politics, as I understand it, is that, you know, the strong figure of the president is what's keeping all this internally conflicted system afloat. So even if they win the election, if then he exits the scene, what's to prevent them from then breaking into open factional struggle or open conflict?
Well, this is the logic of
poisoning each other,
or,
you know, throwing each other in penal colonies willy-nilly for this or that.
This is the logic of the dominant party, which is that if the resource to win elections is this dominant party, if that's the place where voters will always go, then all of those elites are better off fighting it out within that party rather than defecting from the party. So it's not that there will be no elite fighting. There's not that there won't be contention, but it will happen within the party, and they'll fight for party power within the party.
But haven't they essentially been doing that already for the last several rounds of elections? I mean, the name of the party has changed, but
I don't think you could argue that, because it wasn't, you know, 2003. I mean, 2000, you started to see the emergence of a state party that might be successful beyond the future. But if you remember, before 2003, most people predicted United Russia wouldn't do very well. I mean, it was really a shock to people that United Russia did as well as it did. So I think this is actually something new. I mean, I remember being in a room of Konar's people where they just said, there's no way this party will get a majority. So
how do the presidential candidates emerge in your world?
Well, this is what's the most shocking to me is the incumbent gets to select the next president.
And you think there's actually going to be an election? We're not going to have a midnight transition?
Yeah.
Power?
Well, I mean, there are all sorts of polls now about, you know, who would you pick if there was an election? You know who wins all those polls? The person Putin picks. They don't even know who that is, you know. But that's what people say. I'll take anyone that Putin picks. So if he transfers that ability to point to the next person within the party, then it'll always there won't be any way for another candidate to run.
And you think that the idea of someone popular, perhaps in some other realm of life, you know, the Schwarzenegger candidate, that won't happen because they control the media.
They control the media, they control ballot access, they could make all sorts of regulations about how now presidential candidates have to be a party member, and that would mean other parties would actually have to get registered and get on the ballot. It's like why they eliminated Kasyanov's party from the parliamentary race, mm-hmm. right? Because if we view the parliamentary race as a primary for the presidential race, there's no way they can prove their power.
So what is Putin's incentive? I mean, I understand that, you know, the party has incentive for him to step down, Castro, but why would Putin want to create this party-based consolidation of power instead of continuing to rule himself?
There's lots of discussion of that in the Russian press, and which I find very interesting. And some people say, you know, he doesn't want to, he won't, right? Other people say, you know, he's just sick of it. He's sick of being, you know, like, he's sick of the infighting, he's sick of being, you know, he's sick of dealing with this. And so, as chairman of the board of this power, of this party, he doesn't give up much, and it's not so uncertain. I think what you get out of this party is a decrease of uncertainty.
But Regina, what about the fact that there were people that put Putin into power that thought they were going to control him? So now he's going to put people into power that are going to think he's going to think he's going to control them through controlling the party and all this other stuff, and then they are sitting in the catbird seat and they get to do whatever
exactly.
they want.
No,
and
I agree with you.
They're changing the rules.
But what I'm saying is that there are much stronger, both informal and formal, mechanisms to preclude that.
But you yourself just said that those formal mechanisms are capable of being changed in order to serve the interest of whoever holds the reins of power, right? So what's to prevent the person that Putin selects
The term limits.
Well, he had term limits. Putin had term limits, and he's managed to completely reshape the formal institutional structure, right?
So you changed the
Without changing the Constitution.
Well, Putin didn't change the Constitution, and within his term
limits, he managed
to completely reshape, to take Regina's argument. He's completely reshaped, and so what's the...
Because that would require that someone build the same sort of personal popularity that Putin has, independent of the party. Because they have to be able to win the next round.
But you said, I'm just being the devil's advocate here, but the person who's going to be elected is the person that Putin wants, so... So then why is it that person then doesn't get some of Putin's popularity? And then they become the person that's seen as bringing stability and order.
Because I think what you're transferring is the state patronage and but I'm not sure you're transferring the personal link that people have to Putin.
I guess I'm not ever sure that there really is a, Putin's kind of a gray figure. I mean,
well,
people like him because
that's how we see Putin, but that's not how Russians see.
Well, an awful lot of Russians I talk to see him that way. I mean, I don't know what the data shows, but I don't get a sense that they have a warm feeling for the mujik that is Putin, right?
Yeah.
And because he's not really
he's not
a mujik.
That's the whole point, right?
He's an apparatchik, right?
Sober,
and so if some guy does come along,
husband.
The roly-poly mujik, that somehow is able to capture the imagination, a Lushkov kind of figure,
right? Well, I mean, this is why controlling ballot access is so important. But I also think that the data shows that this only happened because Putin had some personal, who can explain? I cannot explain Putin's appeal between September 1999 and December 1999. To me, it's impossible to explain, right? But it happened. And
Chechnya.
Well, stability.
We don't want to believe Chechnya, right?
Yeah.
But it is,
But
it's,
now,
it's
but,
a stability thing.
But now we have all sorts of other threats. That he's the strong.
But the point is that then somebody else is going to become the person that manages those crises. Unless you're saying that he's going to become kind of the guy behind the scenes. And
yeah,
I don't
he's already said he's going to become the guy behind.
But
the
isn't
scenes.
That what Berezovsky thought he was going to be?
Yeah, but Berezovsky didn't have personal popularity through elections. Yeah. I get the argument. I mean, I get that this is a really problematic. There's a reason why these parties are so hard to institutionalize and put in place. But I think there's a moment where this could happen now.
Yeah,
and
well
I guess
it
that's what I'm trying
on
to describe.
Putin, walking into a little bit into the shadows and whether that's just an unknowable at this point. Yeah.
I just have kind of a descriptive question about this party registration process. I found that fascinating is that the kind of requirements that they to get national registration seemed really onerous, and but yet then when you showed the data on the projections for 2007-2008 elections, that you still showed a lot of parties that were going to be contesting elections. So, and you mentioned the Greens and a few others that they sort of let in, even if they probably didn't meet the qualifications, but it looks like there must have been maybe a dozen or so parties that they expected, or 18.
18.
Oh, wow.
None of which had any public opinion presence over 12%.
Okay, but how do those 18 get registered then? How do they meet those requirements? Or
they
don't
didn't.
They don't.
They didn't. They simply were registered. That's the argument, at least from observers, that the registration requirements were so complex and so onerous that they were easily manipulated.
So why doesn't somebody bring a case to the Constitutional Court?
And say that these parties, because it doesn't seem like anyone would be able to qualify.
This was exactly Karen DeWeech's argument, that they could go to the Constitutional Court and the Constitutional Court would...
I don't know what the Constitutional Court would do because that's a whole separate
argument. Well, her argument was that it was independent enough to do anything.
Yeah.
I don't know why they haven't done it. I can tell you no one has made any move towards doing that.
Well, this is an argument. The guy we had last week, Trochev, who's done a lot of work on studying the docket of the Constitutional Court, has argued that you can watch the kind of the courageousness that people don't, there's a chilling effect that's happening, that people don't bring the cases anymore because they don't believe that the court's going to go against Putin, and they don't believe even if they do that anyone's going to enforce the decision.
Eugene Huskey is making that argument at AAAS that there's been this chilling effect in the Constitutional Court now wouldn't make that kind of decision.
Mm-hmm. But they could go back, well.
You know that. It could. Yeah.
I'm wondering about the parallel between the PRI question is basically how far along the road to the PRI in its heyday is United Russia really at this point? Because what little I know about the PRI is that, first of all, they have this enormous interest group structure undergirding it, the so-called sectors. And of course, initially the military, which was thereby neutralized and then removed from the sectoral structure. Second, you have a very close ideological identification of the PRI with the Mexican Revolution.
Right, in the
and
early
not sure
going.
United Russia has anything quite like that.
No. No, that's the sticking point is always the ideology. So we see the emergence of a dominant party in South Africa, and that has largely been on the basis of Mandela still. We saw the Congress Party in India on the basis of revolution. So no, UR doesn't have that. But it does have the capacity and the stability message. Is that enough? I guess I'm arguing it is for now. And that they'll win this election, and it, over the course of the next 4 years, we'll be able to consolidate their hold in a way that will preclude challenges going forward. I see in the regions United Russia starting to build that kind of girding infrastructure. They don't have the military, but they do have the FSB. And they've not been shy about using it to persecute people, even at the regional level. They're building increasingly large bureaucracies within the presidential administration. And so I think they're starting to build that sort of control. You're skeptical about that, huh?
I'm not sure. though I'm wondering, is there sufficient cement that holds the different elites and different groups within the United Russia together apart from Putin and his popularity? Might not last forever, especially if he does in fact leave office.
Right. That's the Achilles heel of the argument. And I guess what I'm trying to say is there's enough for this round. And based on this round, they have another opportunity to start to build more infrastructure to solidify and cement the support. Yeah?
How really difficult would it be for Putin to change his mind and go through the constitutional changes to run again?
Well, there's some debate over this. You guys were saying you need a constitutional amendment to change term limits. Now some people are saying they don't actually need to do that, that they could manipulate that in various institutional ways. My sense is it's not, and that the Constitutional Court would not object to that. That was an argument that a number of people were making. It won't be hard for Putin to change his mind, and that's what I say. If you start to see these cracks, if you start to see the breakdown, my prediction falls apart, and Putin will simply take another tact, which is an authoritarian tact.
I'm not
tact.
Sure your argument falls apart, then. It just may take him longer to do it. That could be the argument, too, is that you don't know, you need another 4 years or something to consolidate.
It could be the case. I mean, I think the problem is a sign of weakness like that will prompt elite defection. To address this side of the room. Like that, having to do that will prompt elite defection, and whether or not he can recapture this momentum, I don't know.
But where are these elites going?
Well, that's the problem. Where are they going?
Yeah.
I mean, one thing that's constitutionally unambiguous is that he can't step down and then run again. It's just the Constitution prohibits him from.
Right, I mean, that's the.
Executive terms, so you can imagine a scenario where
right.
The placeholder and then things fall apart.
But his wife runs,
again.
Scott?
No, he can run. Yeah, I mean, it is possible. It is. Yeah,
they can learn lessons from us.
Hey, it almost worked in Moscow. It was okay. Yeah, I mean, that is the other argument. So things start to fall apart, and he comes like the white knight into the scenario. Yeah.
Another possibility for this. Not working out for Putin would be if the minor parties get their act together and consolidate.
But they can't. No, that was
that was a silly thing. Right.
Yeah. First of all, that's incredibly well. It is interesting.
There are 18 parties,
right?
Because you're projecting.
Right.
He's only
but they can't run as a coalition.
Yeah.
Like they've barred now coalitions, so they
right.
can't
so
officially band together.
Most of them won't even agree to run in a coalition.
Right.
So.
Okay. Right.
Okay.
You're not.
38%, that's hardly hegemonic percentage of the
right.
vote. I mean, that's
right,
what,
right.
it's still a really divided vote.
Right.
So if there's still 62% out there for upper grand.
Okay.
Right.
All
right. So I think I really think that you're going to see them get 48% of the vote, and then with the threshold, they'll easily bump over a majority of seats.
And what's the story of the communists? Just the dying off of their members?
No, that's part of it, but I think it's more that they've proven that they can't get anything done.
Right.
You know, they're on the ballot, so they're always a repository of protest votes, but they're,
mm-hmm.
and they're also pinned really far left,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they can't
still,
move.
They are still a pensioner party, right? I mean, they're...
No, the pensioner party is the pensioner party.
So they're not going to vote communist, the older people? Is that...
They, in the regions, in the last rounds, they voted for the pensioner party. The pensioner party did incredibly well,
mm-hmm.
surprisingly well. And the pensioner party is part of this Just Russia group.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really interesting change in the party dynamic.
Yeah. So, any last questions? Well, please join me in thanking you.